Hello and welcome to the New Space Vision podcast sponsored by LiveView, where we discuss new space technology, finance and innovation with executives, founders and more exciting people from the startup and new space ecosystem. I'm Sam Shivara.
And I'm Daniel Seiland. Together we are the founders of the Earth observation company LiveView and New Space Vision. Today we are very excited to welcome Ingo Baumann, a prominent legal expert in space and technology. Hi Ingo, we are super happy to have you here today.
Hi Daniel, hi Sven. Thanks for having me.
So law and space is not really an obvious connection for most of the people, but we will talk together with you today about all its applications. But before we do that, we typically talk about the personal story. And like Sven and I are curious, how did you become a space lawyer? And what did you do before?
Well, it was already in my studies. In the middle of the studies, I was interested in telecom law, media, broadcasting. That was also still the time of privatization of the telecom sector and also still growth of the private broadcasting sector. So these were my topics of interest. And in the law studies, you had to do two mandatory internships. The first one I did in the Media Supervision Authority of North Rhine-Westphalia. And for the second one, I wanted to go to France and I wanted to do the internship in the media sector. So I asked for some help and contacts, and I got an internship place in Euronews in Lyon, the news television. And just a few days before the internship was supposed to start, they gave me a call and they said, sorry, we have to cancel the internship. Our lawyer is ill or whatever. No, I don't remember. And so I was in a difficult situation because mandatory internship, I had to look for something else. And I called again some people for help. And they said, okay, yeah, you can go to Eutelsat in Paris. I said, Eutelsat? Who said, yeah, they are doing broadcasting satellites. And I said, yeah, great, let's go. And I did this internship. And at the time, it was, if you know that, the privatization of the former intergovernmental satellite organization, Intelsat, Inmarsat, Eutelsat. So they were all in a very complex reform and privatization process, but still in the intergovernmental organization setup. And I found that so fascinating that coming back from the internship, I went to the Cologne Institute of Air and Space Law and said, okay, hello, here I am. And then I participated to first seminars, conferences, wrote first article, etc. And then the second breaking point was a large academic project, Space Law in the 21st Century, Project 2001. And we all got, all the PhD students at the time, they got a project contract with the DLR. And when that contract ended and the research project, then the DLR, occasionally they had a need for several new lawyers. And so a whole bunch of us, I think three or four persons, all from the institute, all within the academic project, they moved into legal positions into DLR. And then I stayed for something like 7-8 years in DLR as an internal lawyer, first taking care of research project contracts, etc. But then after some years, I moved into the big satellite projects, SALUPE, military SATCOM, GMES, which is now Copernicus, and then mainly Galileo. And I did this for several years, also more in management functions, then in addition to the legal functions. And in 2008, myself and another colleague, we left the DLR and established the law firm. And now since 15 years, I'm doing the space law, space industry legal stuff from the law firm.
Yeah. And why did you start your own law firm?
Well, that's a story. At the latest time, I was managing director, administrative managing director of the DLR company, affiliate company for running the Galileo Operations Center. And the question was, shall I continue with my managing director function? And that would have meant moving from Cologne to Oberpfaffenhofen or near Oberpfaffenhofen. And it would have also meant to go away from the legal, let's say, discipline, more to financials, no, HR, and as you know, as CEOs yourself, no, all the topics you have to take care of. And in the end, I decided to stay with the legal profession and to stay in Cologne. Yeah, that's in short the background.
Yeah, and it seems that it was a good decision. So today, what we found online is that you have 16 professional law employees, right? Roundabout.
Overall, the law firm is currently around 25, no? But including office and students, the full time lawyers, it's true. We are currently something like 16.
Yeah. So when you start a company like LifeYo, you have a clear idea for a product, right? But when you start a law firm, it may be a bit different. Like we were asking ourselves, what were the challenges in the beginning? And did you already had some customers, some relationships from before, which you took in to your company, or how did that went?
Well, very limited. Although in fact, we have been apparently quite good in our planning, because for our business plan to establish a law firm, we won the first prize of a new law firm. It's like a startup prize, as you know them, but for law firms. So we won that prize for our business plan. Nevertheless, we started with very, very few projects or clients. And for me, basically trying to build upon the work and the network I had already done in Galileo. So, in fact, Galileo has been certainly, without Galileo, probably we would not exist. For the very first years, this was really our major involvement. Allowed us also to continue and to grow over time into many other areas.
Yeah. So we now talked a lot about your personal background, and obviously you're a lawyer. There's a law firm focused on space technology. But I think a lot of our listeners don't even know why law is important. Obviously, we all are living in a world which is defined by laws, for sure. But like in the space domain, maybe it's special. Could you give us a quick rundown? Like, what's the current legal structure in space, and what have people know about that if they, for example, want to start launching their own rocket company or their own space craft into orbit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, although typically, no, if we talk about space law, typically what we mean is the United Nations space treaties, outer space treaty, liability convention, registration convention, the moon agreement, the rescue agreement, although the set of five international treaties on space activities, also, let's say, the national laws implementing the international law treaties. That's the narrow set of what we mean if we use the term space law. If you use it in a much broader sense, it means let's say all the key legal issues which are specific and important for the space industry. And that's of course a whole different matter. Most of the space companies, they know very well the importance of export control laws and regulations, famous US ITER, but also on the European and German side, of course, we have these type of export regulations, public procurement law to participate to tenders of DLR, the ministry, ESA, EU, all the important public stakeholders, public R&D projects, software licenses, data licenses, contractual matters. Now we talk about artificial intelligence, blockchain, etc. And of course, all these aspects, they have also a legal element in it. So if you take this broader understanding of what legal issues in space are, then it's a very diverse and also very complex picture. And let's say, as you also said, there is somehow a very old perception: space industry, why do we need legal? Well, if you take it objectively and very simple, we talk about a very high value assets and very high value projects, mostly on a transnational level, mostly in rather complex structures, industrial team, consortium, so involving many entities from very big companies to very small ones and across several countries with public agencies involved, sharing of information and data, etc. So while it would be surprising if the legal area would not be of any relevance. What is true is that the space law as such has been very long time almost purely academic exercise. The outer space treaty is from the end of the 60s. Most of the other treaties are from the 70s. Moon agreement was the latest, early 80s. But since 40 years, the international space law, at least on the binding treaty level, has not developed. So we have a standstill since a very long time. And also, let's say, these treaties are rather high-level principles, and their practical relevance for a very long time has been extremely low. Just as an example, the Liability Convention, which regulates, let's say, the damage caused by space objects, either in space, in air, or on ground. And until today, after more than 40 years, we still don't have any case under this liability convention. There has been never any claim, any formal procedure under this. So a lot I don't say speculation, but it was academic exercise. What would be and how is this definition and how do we interpret? But it was academic. So my first space law events, they were all with the famous space law professors and really academic. And it's now thanks to you, LiveU and all the other companies, new space companies. This is also very much the driver for the legal aspects to become much more relevant than they have been in the past.
Yeah, and we because it's a very abstract topic, we now in the next minutes we want to go through, let's say, three very, very practical examples. And so let's start with the past. What, in your opinion, let's say the space race, right, 60s, 70s, what was the most important space law back then which had a big impact, or was there any at all?
Well, the UN space treaties, they started, in fact, to be discussed as soon as Sputnik launched. The US and the former URSS, they were the two space powers in Cold War scenario, and with the fear and threat of a nuclear war, and also potentially nuclear missiles going through space or even being located in space. And at the time, we had a very futuristic understanding of space. We all know that the expectation was that in a few years we would see stations on the moon, we would see things which even today are still quite far away. And therefore, there was really a very high interest, mainly of the two superpowers, to find some kind of balance, some kind of key principles, not limiting their freedom and of movement in space, including also for military things, but nevertheless excluding the extension of the conflict into a hot conflict in space. So one of the elements, therefore, was also a ban to station nuclear weapons in space. That was one of the elements. But nevertheless, it went beyond, and it also adopted principles which are nowadays also of key relevance for the commercial space industry, the need to register space objects on national and also UN level, the liability questions, and mainly also the duty of the states to authorize and supervise national non-governmental space activities, meaning mainly private commercial space activities. And that's why in many countries and increasing number of countries, we see now national space laws under which if you would like to launch or operate, you need a very complex license with very detailed conditions.
Yeah, I can imagine. And like I would have a question because I was always asking myself, like from an engineering perspective, nuclear propulsion would be so cool, right? But you don't see it. I mean, there's the risk that in the launch of such an engine, you know, maybe you have a launch failure and then you have a lot of troubles. But now I thought, okay, the United Nations treaties regarding nuclear weapons, was it regulated in the same law that you can't actually put up nuclear propulsion?
No, on the nuclear propulsion, we don't have that in the treaties, but there is what we call a principle declaration. So the United Nations General Assembly from time to time adopted very important resolutions, which comprised the setting of certain principles for certain application. That was the case for Earth observation, for satellite broadcasting, and it would also for the nuclear power systems. Yeah. Also after it became very expensive in the first place, but also I mentioned the liability convention and that there was never any formal case, but of course there was a famous accident, which was a Russian satellite going down in Canada, and this satellite also had a nuclear propulsion system. And while nothing really serious happened, but there was some contamination on ground. And for quite many years, the nuclear power propulsion systems, they disappeared. Too complex, too dangerous, too expensive. And it's interesting that now they are coming back. So they are coming back mainly for deep space exploration, and long distance missions, no? But
This podcast is sponsored by LifeView. LifeView's mission is to unlock the full potential of Earth observation data for humanity and life on Earth through AI. We are the global market leader in infrastructure monitoring and are bringing the power of satellite data analytics to other industries globally. Talk to us to find out how satellite data can benefit you and your company via podcast at live-eo.com. Limitations, but maybe let's come back to this topic of new space. Exactly, yes, this podcast is called New Space Vision and more about like the commercial applications in space. We are an Earth observation company and obviously we look at satellite images. And there's a hard cap on the resolution of satellite images right now, or there used to be. In the governmental space, that you only were able to produce satellite images with a resolution of 30 centimeters due to some US regulations, which is now being lifted, and that you can theoretically get images with a higher resolution than that if you get special permission by the US government. Maybe tell us a little bit about do you see any other regulation coming up in the near future from any other players, like governmental players, when it comes to regulating satellite resolutions, or do you see any movement in like the complete liberation of what you can take, what kind of pictures you can take from space, and what are, from a legal perspective, the main drivers for such a regulation? Why can't satellite operators just take pictures with a resolution of 5 centimeters, 1 centimeter, whatever?
Yeah, also the US, as also in other areas, was the first in the 80s to consider a commercialization and privatization of the Earth observation industry. Before, it was a matter reserved for science and for the military and intelligence. And as in other policies, the US considered, well, let's create a commercial industry. And they were very careful. No? And in fact, what you mentioned, the resolution limits and also other conditions, they are, since the 80s, they are a moving target. No? Along with the technology development, the possibilities of the military, what other nations have, what other companies in the global market are allowed to do. So over time, these limits are always adapted, and they are ever more limited, as you said, 30 centimeter now even going down. This is a step by step development over many years, and it's quite interesting. There are only very few countries in the world which have a dedicated regulation for the Earth observation systems, operations, but also for the data. It's the US, Canada, France, Germany, Finland, and we counted as well, even if the actual relevance is not so high, also in Russia. So we have only, let's say, 5 Western plus Russia. And these countries, they have a very detailed regulation. The driver is, of course, mainly military interests. You only permit to go into the market what you think can be released under military aspects, but also, let's say, the broader security policy, foreign policy, also play a role. And the funny thing is, for Germany, because we know, as we all know, Germany still does not have a space law, but what we have is since even now 16 years already is the Satellite Data Security Act. And the regulation under it, which in a very complex and detailed manner regulate the operations of Earth observation systems from a sensor-driven perspective, and let's say the reception and dissemination of sensitive data coming from these systems.
Mm. Yeah, so I would have a question regarding that, because we always also getting asked, regarding the resolution and the limitation of Earth observation data. And then it's always the question like, okay, who is actually responsible there? Let's make a practical case here. Like Sven and I want to launch a hardware company, just theoretically, right? And we say, we want to build a very large satellite with 5 centimeter resolution, and the company is located in Latvia, so not in Germany, not in France, not in the US. Who is then telling us that we can't do that? Because 5 centimeter was not possible in the past from a regulatory perspective.
Yeah, well, if the company is based in Latvia, if the contract for the launching is signed by your Latvian company, the control center is also in Latvia, there are some aspects and parameters we need to consider. But if all these are done from Latvia, then Latvia is the responsible state. So now, for the moment, to my knowledge, Latvia is also working on some national space law, as many other nations for the moment, but they still have not adopted it. But at least without research, let's assume that. No? So at the moment, you would not be subject to any specific licensing and licensing conditions and restrictions. However, no, and that is quite obvious. If such a company appears and emerges in a certain country, then the state sooner or later will also set up a legislation and a regulatory regime for that company. The best example is Finland, which has adopted a space law and now also a very specific Earth observation regulation following the establishment of ISAI. And in Germany, the German Satellite Data Security Act 2007 was adopted following the TerraSAR Tandem project, which is a public-private partnership between DLR and Airbus, and which allows Airbus to commercialize the TerraSAR data. And the TerraSAR data, radar data, of course, no, you can use day and night, all weather, and at the time a very advanced technology. So there were also the security, military, foreign policy interests concerned. And so, no, in our case, you going to Latvia, establishing a very high resolution operator company, it's quite likely that then we would also see a national space law with specific aspects regulating your activity.
But so that sounds okay. I launched a satellite with 5 centimeter. Then the Latvian government may follow with the law, but it still sounds very attractive to me. But is it then possible to sell in the US and so on? Like, or is this then actually the point, you know, why people don't do this?
Also typically, no, these laws and regulations, they concern the launch and the operations of an Earth observation system, at least one which has a certain capability. No? And it also regulates, let's say, the first entry into the market of the sensitive data created by it. But once the first step into the market is has been allowed, then the circulation of the data is then free. Yeah? So the state, in that sense, it reserves the right to control, let's say, the creation of the data by regulating the operations of the system, and it regulates let's say the first steps, the reception on ground by the operator, and then the first step of the dissemination. But all the value adding companies, no? And that's also why in fact we had and still have a quite lively creation of the down, what we call the downstream Earth observation market, no? Because once a certain set of data is allowed to be disseminated, then all the other companies, no, they can take it and do the value adding and their projects, etc. No? But the state controls what is allowed to be sold, offered, disseminated in the first place.
But it still sounds like on an international landscape, you have to find a place where you can do that, and you have to find the right satellite operators which can support you with that endeavor. But then you are free, and there doesn't seem to be like a space police which enforces the regulation globally, because just there's no global law for all of that. But before we go on, maybe on the global scale, you've said that Germany doesn't have a space law. Now, Germany obviously is a big country, and you've been very publicly also, like in some of the biggest German newspapers, about that Germany needs a space law. The question is, obviously, there are always some people screaming for more regulation, other people say, hey, we need less regulation. Why does Germany need a space law? Maybe in 5 sentences for the layman. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, as you say, no, you can have different perspectives. You can take the state perspective, you can take the company perspective, and clearly, yeah, as a company, you don't like, and usually you don't scream for regulation or even more detailed, tougher regulation. Yeah? That's typically not the case. So if in this discussion, myself, also many others have said Germany needs a space law that concerns the state perspective. And if you take a bit of the history, in fact, Germany is working since almost 20 years on a national space law. And for some time, 20 years ago, Germany has even been the driver and most advanced state on the international level. So in the preparation, in the academic occupation with the topic, etc., etc. But still, we don't have it. What's the reason? Why Germany, until very recently, did not have any commercial operator. So there were, of course, some university projects. There was what I mentioned, the public-private partnership for TerraSAR. But it was until RapidEye emerged that Germany had no commercial operator, launch service provider, of course, even less, but also no private satellite operator. And therefore, there was, in the end, there was no pressing need to do something. As I said earlier, in Finland, ICEI emerged. Okay, then the state reacted with the law and the regulations. And in Germany, this need was not there because there was no operator. And the few university projects, they all received public money through DLR. So there was a good interaction and good control anyway. And that's why it took a long time. But now, of course, we have ESA Aerospace, High Impulse, Rocket Factory. So we have already three micro-launcher companies. We have other companies working on air launch with different concepts, a bit like Virgin is doing, but also self-flying, other type of air launch technologies. We have the potential operator of the German launch platform in the North Sea. We have several Earth observation constellation operators, Constellar, AuroraTech. We have Vioma planning to launch satellites for space-based surveillance and tracking, and so on and so on. Yeah?
But why do these companies need a law? Like, exactly, how does it support them? Yeah.
No, the companies don't need the law. The state needs the law because under the Outer Space Treaty and the other UN treaties, Germany is obliged under international law to authorize and supervise private space activities. And while in order to do so, you need an authorization regime, which means licensing, in usual language, licensing regime. And under the license, you need also an authority, an administration to supervise whether the company complies with the license, the law, the conditions, etc. So the main driver is really, hey, now we have commercial space activities, therefore now we need an authorization and supervision regime. Then we also have the registration of space objects, which so far is also not regulated in Germany. So if you would launch your Earth observation satellite and for some reason you would be too lazy or you don't even know about it, you would not give the necessary information on your satellite to DLR and the German Civil Aviation Authority. They could not register your satellite in the national register. They could also not provide the information to the UN register. And they cannot even force you to provide the information because there is no legal basis. And finally, also the liability.
So right now there's Wild West, and if I launch a satellite from Germany, Germany is accountable, or potentially if the company goes bankrupt, Germany would be accountable for it, but no one would know about it. And then suddenly it would, like, someone could, like, my satellite crashed into, I don't know, the ISS, and the company faltered a couple of years back. Germany would be accountable, but Germany potentially wouldn't even know about it because currently there's no real need to give yes. any yeah, yeah? Okay. Yes. Sounds like an interesting setup for sure. Okay, now I understand why we need to set space law.
That totally makes sense, yeah. So we're already coming to an end. So we want to look a bit into the future and also like a new space. What are the big questions or the hot future topics in space law from your perspective?
Oh, there are quite some. Yeah? If you take the international level, the big question is how can we bring movement into the United Nations or in other international organizations, how can we bring movement into the development of international space? As we said, since the 80s, no further treaties, and the old treaties, they are excellent, they are super important, but they are like the constitutional law. They are very high level principles, but they don't give the, let's say, practical level of information. Imagine a very simple case. A company from country A has a satellite. It's registered in the register of that country A. Now the company maybe does not develop so well or is doing a merger, and or is the satellite, in fact, is now owned by another company in country B. How can you change the national the registration and the United Nations registration to say, hey, okay, yeah, it was in country A, now it's in country B? And as the industry is emerging and getting more normal, like any other industry, these cases, of course, now are realistic.
So, for example, the old Rapid Eye satellites, right? The company was bought by Planet, which is a US-based company, but Rapid Eye satellites were German satellites. And so that's a practical example of the problem you've just described, right?
The whole topic of sustainability in the broader sense, which includes or is linked to a lot of other topics, space debris mitigation, space traffic management, space sustainability, but also, let's say, environmental sustainability issues in more earthbound, so environmental damage due to launches, etc. All these things as environmental and climate topics are highest on the agenda anyway. This now is also the case for the space industry. We have the United Nations Space Debris Mitigation Guidelines, but as we all know, with that minimum 25 years rule, they are outdated. And they are not adapted and sufficient for what we see now, the launch of mega constellations, thousands of new satellites every year, launches every day, etc. So it's not sufficient. But the development on international level is very slow. It takes years and years of discussion. And in the current geopolitical environment, with the tensions with Russia, increasing tensions with China, the international development gets even more complicated than it was anyway. And so how can we create a space traffic management? The EU has proposed something and said, okay, if we are not moving forward on international level, let's do something on European level. But space has no national borders. And therefore, an effective space traffic management regime can only be global. But how can you do it? Another, if we have spoken about national space law, the big issue here is how to, as a state, how to regulate the new space sector. So the old companies, but let's say the new space developments with all the new applications, all the new technologies, on-orbit servicing, private space stations, space tourism, commercial mining, micro launchers, mega constellations, and all these different things. How can you regulate them in an effective way, also securing the safety of space operations, the sustainability of space operations, the interests of developing countries, for example, and other aspects, and at the same time support the growth, the competitiveness of your commercial industry.
Yeah.
And this conflict of, well, we need to be stricter on the one hand, because now we need to secure the safety and sustainability of the space environment and some of the activities with new launchers, mega constellations, they also create very specific and quite intensive risks. So yeah, we need to regulate it, but we also want the new space sector, the new companies, the private investment, the competitiveness, new jobs, growth, etc. We also want to support this. And this is the dilemma all the countries from the US, UK, France, Germany, others are now faced with. And almost no country has so far found the right balance between these two interests. No? And if you look to the UK, they have created a new space law, let's say, extremely detailed with lots of regulations and guidelines and forms and approaches, etc., super detailed. And it was really driven by the aim to be the one of the leaders in the world in the commercial space industry. That was the whole driver for this new legislation in the UK. And while now it's there and we have the first experiences, and what's happening is that the companies are heavily complaining because it's so complex and demanding. You know? Yeah. And there's now a lot of criticism. But still, and that's in fact the best example. And that's also why still today Germany is struggling so far, because we need to do, the state need to do something. We need to have a space legislation, but how to do it without killing, restricting, limiting the competitiveness of the German companies concerned.
Yeah, so it's about finding a nice or the just this exactly thin line. So maybe one short final question before we close the podcast. You've been obviously in the space ecosystem since the early 2000s, and we first time met in 2016 at our New Space Vision conference. What has surprised you the most in terms of development of the New Space ecosystem?
Oh, that's a good question. I think there are so many surprising aspects, no? Starting with Elon Musk, SpaceX becoming really the successful and dominant global company, which it is today. Right? If we all remember several years back, especially we in Germany, we said, another explosion, they will never make it, they will go bankrupt, it's impossible, etc. Now we see the result. The growth of the private investment, how relatively easy it has become for a startup company to get at least the first millions. We know in Europe the big tickets are still extremely complicated if you go above 40 millions. But nevertheless, German example, ESA Aerospace, they have received now already more than 200 million, to my knowledge. Extremely outstanding for the European market. But let's say it's also, on the other hand, it's also not so surprising, because while if you look to the products, services, technologies which the new space companies they use, it's in fact technologies which have been developed over sometimes decades and which simply now have the maturity to be really implemented and used, 3D printing, militarization, digitalization, serial production. How can it be that in a matter of a few years you develop as a small startup company your own launcher? Because the science technology basis is now there allowing it.
So to summarize, it's development of the launcher ecosystem. But Daniel, I think you have the last one.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, very interesting that you say it was somehow, so it's big, right? A lot of things are happening, but if you zoom out, you could also see this coming, right, with all the tech trends. And there were a lot of people who shaped the ecosystem and the industry. And we would love to hear from you. We asked every guest actually who we should have next as a guest in the New Space Vision podcast. So who would you nominate?
Well, a very outstanding and extraordinary person is now back from the US to Germany, Hans Königsmann, the former chief engineer of SpaceX. And my recommendation would be to approach him and try to get him for one of your next sessions.
We're going to try to do that. So thank you very much, Ingo, for giving us a quick introduction into the matters of space law. Everyone, Ingo also has an online shop where he sells space related stuff. Exactly, what's the name of the shop?
House of Space. Yeah, that was my hard lockdown project. I had a little bit too much time and I was collecting and these type of things myself. So during the hard lockdown, I established this small online shop for space and science fiction, vintage robots, etc., etc. So thanks for mentioning it. Have a look. It still needs to grow. Yeah, it's just a little side hobby activity.
So make sure to check that out, House of Space. Make sure to check out Ingo Baumann on LinkedIn and BHO Legal generally. Thank you very much, Ingo, for spending time with us. And to all the listeners, thank you very much for tuning in again. Make sure to follow also New Space Vision on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, wherever you get your updates. And make sure to tune in also for the next time when we're talking again with cool movers of the New Space ecosystem. Thanks a lot.
All right, lift off and the clock is started.
Liftoff. We have a liftoff.